Started. Okay, so our topic for tonight is the inconclusive election of 1984. The only time Israel had a tie. Nobody won. So just to recap a little bit of the highlights of last time, Menachem Begin resigned as prime minister on roughly around his 70th birthday in September of 1983, and Yitzhak Shamir was able to defeat David Levy in a primary election in Likud, and then Yitzhak Shamir was able to defeat Ariel Sharon in another primary in the run-up to the 84 election. And so you now have a national election for the 11th Knesset that is, of course, going to be a competition between the two major blocs, left and right, the Likud versus the alignment. But what's going to be very different about this election as opposed to the previous one is that whereas in 1981 the two major parties won 95 out of 120 seats, and basically the winner of those two was going to win, and it was the Likud, in 84 the smaller parties will play a much more significant role. There will be 15 parties elected to the Knesset. It's a tremendous number. So many minor parties, each one with a little quirk to them, an ideological bent that is not something we've necessarily seen before, and there will be no winner. So, what was happening in the early 80s that leads up to 1984 that can be a platform from which the Likud or the Labour Party could run on? So, from the Likud perspective, what they're going to run on is that they provide security for the country. What they're going to ignore is that the Lebanon War was decidedly unpopular in terms of the loss of people, of casualties, and of materiel. But they'll conveniently sidestep that and say it's part of the broader context of defending Am Yisrael, that we're using the IDF in a very aggressive fashion to defend our citizenry. We're not afraid to fight for our survival. That's how they spin the war in their favor. Of course, the other thing they would argue is that in the early 1980s, the perspective of the alignment had been becoming a bit more dovish, and they're interested in returning some of the territories to the Jordanians or to whomever. They want to see an advanced peace process, and Likud's going to run on the platform of Eretz Yisrael, of settlement building, and the like. Okay. What's the alignment going to run on? Well, they're basically going to run on one thing. The Likud is incompetent. And the country is in dreadful situation, that there was a stock market collapse in October of 83. There's hyperinflation. There's a war in Lebanon that doesn't have an end in sight. That in every respect, every major policy decision made by the Likud government has been an abysmal failure.
This was still Begin?
This was Begin and Shamir.
And Shamir.
Yeah. So that's the alignment's point of view. And they made a conscious decision not to run a very ideological campaign, not to run on the falsity of Likud ideology, but rather just to say, those guys don't know what they're doing. So why would you vote for them again? Vote for the stable hand, the steady hand, that can run the ship of state. And they downplayed any ideological division between the two major blocs. Well, was there a big division? The truth is, there was similarity on some of the key issues. Both parties agreed no discussions with the PLO. Both parties agreed no Palestinian state. And both parties agreed no removal of settlements in Judea and Samaria. So what's the difference? The difference is that the Labour Party would not be in favor of building many more, whereas the Likud wants to build aggressively and all over the place, and that Likud is not really interested in giving up territory in the West Bank or Gaza to a foreign national entity only to give autonomy for the local Arabs, whereas the Labour Party is willing to trade land for peace.
Well, okay. What about the differences on the economy?
So on the economy, it's funny. The Likud was becoming less and less of a real capitalist party. The liberal wing, capital L, of Likud, because remember, what is Likud? Likud is Chayrut and the liberals, Gachal, plus a bunch of little smaller groups. The liberals, capital L, are upper middle class types who want to have less government regulation and an open economy where you can make a lot of money. Whereas Chayrut basically is a populist party that believes in spending a lot of government money on social welfare programs, oftentimes money that the government doesn't have, so they run up a tremendous debt. Well, the Labour Party, in theory, if it was a socialist party, would also favor massive entitlement spending, but actually the Labour Party was becoming increasingly less socialist. Why? And this is an important point. The driving force behind the Labour Party, its ideological bent on domestic issues, was actually no longer the socialist wing. We're going to talk about how Mapam was thinking of breaking away and forming their own party. And they didn't do that, but they were the real socialists. The main body of the Labour Party was now being pushed ideologically by Shinui and the Citizens' Rights Movement, which was less interested in conventional socialism of government control of production or distribution, and just focusing on the rights of the individual and having a secular state. So basically what today we would call merits was really pushing labor in a certain direction, away from classical 1940s and 50s socialism. All right. So this was a very low-key campaign. Both parties wanted it that way because 1981 was a disaster. 1981 was the Ashkenazim versus the Sephardim, the whites versus the darks, and ethnic hatred. It was a horrible campaign with all sorts of foul language and violence in the streets. And nobody wanted to see that again. So both of the major parties ran a very subdued campaign, and until it got to the television stage, which is 1 month before Election Day, which was July 23rd, you really didn't feel as though it was a campaign. You know, now, in this 2019, already for a few months already, it's been all wall-to-wall coverage. That's because there's more media outlets now than there were back then. But back then, there were newspapers and the like, and radio, but it was pretty quiet until television a month before. Okay. The big question that the Likud had to face was, and for that matter, the whole political system, this was the 11th Knesset election. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 all had one thing in common, Menachem Begin, that he was the leader of the right-wing party. The charismatic figure of Menachem Begin was the leader of either the opposition or the incumbent going into the last round of two in the first 10 Knesset elections. This is the first time you don't have him. How will the Likud party hold up without their charismatic leader? As it turned out, they did pretty well. They go down a little bit for reasons having nothing to do with leadership, having to do with their competence in terms of management. But basically, the voters who gravitated towards the man had already formed a loyalty to the party, not just to the man. And so they're willing to stay with their electoral choice despite the fact that he's now secluded in an apartment in Yerushalayim. Huh? Of course, there are plenty of new voters, and the new voters tended to vote Likud also. The younger people were decidedly in favor of right-wing politics. Now, the other consideration is that neither of the major parties had a very... Perez. Neither of the leading candidates, Shamir and Perez, inspired a lot of confidence. Shamir was like an old curmudgeonly type who, from the Likud perspective, was a nice transitional figure until we get to the next generation of leadership, whenever that will happen. And it doesn't happen until 1992, when Shamir loses finally and Bibi takes over. But Peres also, no one really likes Shimon Peres. He doesn't get a big crowd like Begin did, or like Golda Meir did, or like David Ben-Gurion did.
Why?
He wasn't all that lovable.
He was a bureaucrat.
He was a bureaucrat. Yeah, okay. He was No, not in the least. Also, he could be nasty at times. Okay. He didn't have a warm streak to him with the crowd. Really, he did not have that. He wore a suit that never seemed to fit right. And it just... He didn't win over the crowd. That's true, but so was everybody else.
So was Shamir.
Yeah. What I would say about Peres is Peres made several miscalculations in 1984. Very bad miscalculations. Number one, Shamir offered a deal to Peres that before the election, they raised the threshold. The threshold was at 1%. Today it's at 3.25%. But there was a discussion of raising it to 2.5%. So anything above 1%. Why? Because the two major parties recognized that 1981 wasn't going to repeat itself, and that the minor parties were going to do quite well, precisely because the two major parties were not focusing on an ideological campaign, and people who want a real platform are going to gravitate towards these boutique parties. So Peres would have done well to accept that deal. He rejected it, and in the end it was what undermined him, because the right-wing small parties amounted to a lot more than the left-wing small parties. And had those been negated because they fell below the threshold, the alignment would have won. That was his first big mistake. His second big mistake was in determining who should speak for the party and what kind of platitudes should be put out there. Peres believed that if they ran a sort of a Parv campaign without espousing a real agenda, just sort of negating the Likud, saying, you guys don't know what you're doing, that it would be good because the left-wing voter will vote for us anyway, and the right-wing voter will not vote for us if we disparage right-wing ideology. We just have to say that the right-wing party, it doesn't do a good job once they're given control of the government. So we're not trying to win converts, we're trying to win voters. The difference between converts and voters. A convert is someone who used to be a real right-winger and has an epiphany and realizes, no, the right-wing is wrong and the left-wing is right. And they forever change their partisan affiliation. As opposed to changing a voter, you know, some people are fickle. There's the floating vote that changes from one cycle to the next. And maybe Likud got them last time, but we'll get them this time. So the mistake was in thinking that the floating vote was a centrist moderate vote. It was not. The floating vote this time was actually the voter who was looking for a strong statement of principle and found it in bizarre parties on the fringes of society and did not find it in the alignment or the Likud. Okay. So, Likud, for its part, understood what labor was doing and it had a strategy to counter that. In the debates, they would say, whatever happened to Yossi Sarid? How come we don't hear about him anymore? Where's Abba Ibn? How come he hasn't been heard from lately? In other words, find the most dovish voices in the alignment who had been told to shut up and say nothing because the alignment didn't want to be seen as a far-left party, but rather as the main centrist party in Israel. So the Likud says, where is Sarid? Where is Abba Ibn? Well, bring them back to the front. What do they have to say for themselves? The other thing was, so who represents the right flank of the alignment? Yitzhak Rabin. Strong on defense, break the bones of the Arab protesters, okay, you get the point. So there was a debate between Moshe Arends and Yitzhak Rabin, the defense minister and the shadow defense minister. And at the end of the debate, they have the shaking of the hands, you know, at center court, and Arends says to the camera, "New Rabin, if that's what you believe in, how come you don't join the Likud?" It was a very skilled move. It was trying to show that the Labour Party spoke with two voices. That on the one hand, Rabin is almost Likudnik. And on the other hand, you have Sarid and Ibn and the others who are real doves. And so what is the party? The party is a catch-all. It's a mishmash. It doesn't stand for anything. How could you vote for it? Okay. Well, let's now turn to the lesser parties and see how they siphoned off votes from the big players. Tichia. What is Tichia? The far-right party, although in this election they weren't the furthest to the right, but they fashioned themselves as being the super-nationalist party, Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, don't give up an inch, not one inch, led by Geula Cohen and Yuval Ne'eman. In 1981, Tichia had won 3 seats. This time around, Tichia would win 5 seats. Why? Well, because it was felt that the Likud was insufficiently hardline, that it had bungled a few issues during its time in government. People were dissatisfied with the Lebanon War. And if you were a hardliner, Tichia was a nice compelling case of let's hold on to the territories forever. Moreover, the Likud never annexed anything other than the Golan Heights, okay, and recognized by Trump, you know, 2 days ago. Okay, so, but as for the West Bank and Gaza, it was basically the status quo other than the fact that settlements were being built. But from the standpoint of the legalities of things, no statements were made. So Tichia is in favor of real annexation. And some people go for that. So they siphoned away some votes from the Likud and they got 5 seats. They were the largest of the minor parties. Now when I say they were the largest of the minor parties with 5 seats, that's already shocking. That means there are no mid-sized parties. What happened to the good old days when the National Religious Party would win 10, 12 seats, or the General Zionist, this or that? There used to be mid-sized parties. Well, gone. They don't exist anymore. Tichia with 5, everybody else with less. So, let's now turn to the religious. The religious parties is where the action is at in 1984. In 1981, 3 religious parties made the Knesset. Maftal, an NRP, the Aguda, and Tommy, the Sephardic breakaway of Abu Chatzera, the criminal. So, and I don't say it to disparage him, he was a criminal, and that plays a role in how many seats he's going to win. But who didn't make the Knesset in 81? The Poalei Aguda. The Poalei Aguda failed to make the threshold because they were offering something that nobody needed. They were a right-wing party in the territories, a not one-inch party, far, far to the right, but moderate Haredi on matters of religion and state. So if you wanted a far to the right party on territories, you voted for Tichiyahu for Likud. And if you wanted a Shomer Shabbos party, you could vote for the National Religious or for the Aguda. So the Poalei Aguda sort of fell into no man's land, and they got nothing. But they didn't disappear. They were still in the air, hoping to get back into the Knesset. And they had an opportunity. Their opportunity came with the collapse, the utter collapse of the National Religious Party. The National Religious Party always fashioned itself as the third largest party in Israel. There's a major left-wing party, a major right-wing party, and we are the religious Zionists. We represent, you know, all the knitted yarmulke types. And they used to win a lot of seats and be a major party, a mid-sized party. In 1981, they had a horrible collapse. They went from 12 seats to 6, in part because right-wing voters voted for Likud or Tichiyah, mostly for Likud because they wanted Begin to win the election, and they didn't want to take a chance of voting for the religious party when maybe the Labor Party will win. So we have to vote for the Likud, otherwise we'll have a left-wing government. Well, having been cut into 6 from 12 isn't a problem, because the NRP wants to build itself back up, and they recognize we can't just say, vote for us and you'll get a Likud government, because we're with the Likud. Because if you're going to say that, what's the voter going to do? Just vote for the Likud. All right? So they needed to have some sort of a nuanced difference between the other right-wing parties and themselves. And they decided, you know what? Everyone else, before the election, is announcing which bloc they will join to form a government. You know, we'll go with Labor, we'll go with Likud. All the little boutique parties pretty much said in advance, we are on the right or we are on the left. And if the right wins, we're in the government. And if the left or the left wins, we're in the government. The NRP said, no, we could go either way. We could play for either team. And historically, that was true. They always did. They played with the Labor when the Labor was in charge, and they played with Likud when Likud was in charge. But they said, we're not going to announce who we favor. Well, that didn't sit well with voters, because there were very few left-of-center NRP voters anyway, so the right-wingers got all disgruntled. Well, how can you say this? This doesn't make any sense. And they bolted. So Rav Chaim Druckman, who was the leader of basically the Gush Emunim faction of the NRP, decided, you know what? We're out of here. We're gone. We're going to form a new party called Matzad, Miflaget Tzioni Dati, the Zionist Religious Party. Zionist Religious Party. Not the National Religious Party, but the Zionist Religious Party, Matzad. But he was going to fall below the threshold. He didn't stand much of a chance of making it. So he pulled a smart move. He combined forces with the Poalei Aguda, and they created a Morasha, a new party called Morasha. It was a combination of Poalei Aguda and Matzad. And they just made it above the threshold. They actually got 2 seats. So the NRP was furious. Furious that Rav Druckman, who was such a leader in the religious Zionist community, was now collaborating with non-Zionists. That the Poalei Aguda are non-Zionists. How could you, Rav Druckman, with a knitted yarmulke, be in cahoots with non-Zionists? So Maftal started running ads on TV. Bli aval, bli aval, rak achshav, hatzba Maftal. No ifs, no buts, now you have to vote for Maftal, for the NRP. Meaning, in the commercial itself, it was already saying, I know you folks out there have all sorts of excuses to vote for a different party, but don't. Vote for the National Religious Party. Now, how did Rav Druckman defend himself against the accusation that he was collaborating with non-Zionists? So the answer is very important. Aguda, is it anti-Zionist or non-Zionist? So it's a trick question. It depends upon what decade. In the 1920s, 1930s, and early 1940s, it's anti. By the mid-1940s, it's becoming non-Zionist. By the 1970s, the Aguda is just another Israeli party. It's as Zionist as anybody else, okay? They're rooting for the good guys, not for the Arabs. So the Apollo Aguda was historically closer to the national religious camp than the regular Aguda, because they had an economic ideology of moderate socialism. So the Apollo Aguda had kibbutzim, moshavim, had people serving in the army. They were basically no different than the Bnei Akiva, except the yarmulke looked different. So therefore, the accusation that Rav Drukman is collaborating with non-Zionists was nonsense. It's just another religious party, and it's a competitor to the NRP, and so therefore they didn't like it. Okay, yeah.
I'd like to understand all of this in the context of America's politics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These parties that come and go.
Right.
Are they all driven by personality and philosophy, or does money play a role?
So money will play a role for one party. Money played a big role. That was Tommy. Tommy was supported by Nissim Gaon, the Swiss billionaire, who I think is still alive. I think he's like 96 years old. And he gave money to Abuchatzera, and that's what got them three seats in 1981. But Abuchatzera was convicted of larceny and breach of trust and thievery, and so he got knocked down to one seat. He didn't serve time, so he was able to stay in the Knesset. But other than that, money didn't play much of a role, because Israel has laws preventing that. And also, money can play a role only when you have sophisticated campaigns. A lot of this was in the streets, in the minds of the public, not in mass media. Okay, so the NRP has a competition. It's not going to do all that well. Another party, the Aguda. The Aguda is in trouble. The Aguda gets cut down to two seats because there's infighting. I mentioned this briefly last time. Who are the two leading figures in the ultra-Orthodox world who are political rabbis? The Gera Rebbe and Rav Shach. And the Gera Rebbe and Rav Shach don't like each other. Each one has his own view of the relation between the ultra-Orthodox community and the State of Israel, and each one wants his people to ascend to the top of the political heap. Rav Shach is Panovich, right. So Rav Shach was anti-Israel. The Gera Rebbe was pro-Israel, if you want to use, to dumb it down. And the Gera Rebbe believed that the state needed to do certain things to be more Jewish. And Rav Shach couldn't care less. So most importantly was the issue of law of return, amending the law of return so that only converts under halakha could qualify, as opposed to converts under the non-Orthodox denominations who, whatever their status might be. So Rav Shach said, we don't care about that. Our people marry our people, and if the State of Israel declares somebody's a Jew, that doesn't matter to me. If they're not Jewish, they're not Jewish. What does it matter what a passport from the Zionist says? Whereas the Gera Rebbe took a more integrationist point of view, I guess, and said, no, we care what the State of Israel says about people's identity, so therefore we have to amend the law to make sure we don't have to declare people Jews who aren't Jewish. All right. Now, the Aguda had done significant political work in the two terms under Begin and Shamir. From 77 to 84, the Likud got a lot of what it wanted. A lot. For example, what? El Al stopped flying on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Prior to that, it was flying on Shabbos. The Aguda got what it wanted, yeah. The Aguda got what it wanted. So, no flying on Shabbos, okay? There was limitation on public transport in certain cities, okay? Laws on pork, laws on autopsy, laws on abortion for non-therapeutic reasons. In many areas where the halakha would be concerned, the Aguda was able to push forth its agenda under the two terms of 77 to 84. Where they didn't get what they wanted was on the law of return. It was not amended, okay? And certain other things that they would have preferred in terms of, they got no conscription of girls into the army who professed religious observance. But there's more that the Aguda wants, notably money for its educational institutions. And so they need to be well represented. But they're having infighting between the Misnagdic faction and the Hasidic faction, and that's going to cost them. But most importantly, what will cost them is their indifference to their Sephardic constituency. what will happen? So Rav Shach, who's now like the agitator, willing to undermine the Aguda as a political institution because he's not getting his way, because the Ger Rebbe is more powerful, he tells the Sephardim, run on a separate list. And they do. Now, in 1983, they ran as Shomrei Sfarad in the Jerusalem municipal elections, and they did very well. They repeated it in the 84 Knesset elections and did very, very well. So, which leads to a question. How could a new Sephardic party do so well as to win four seats, the same number as the NRP, twice the number of the Aguda, okay, on its first try? And what makes the question even more difficult to answer is, it's an ethnic party. Well, how did ethnic parties do in the state of Israel? In 1949 and 1951, there were two ethnic parties, a Yemenite and a generic Sephardic. And in those two elections, each time, those parties won one and two seats for a total of three. Between in Knesset's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, you know how many ethnic parties won a seat in the Knesset? Zero. And you know why? Because it's Israel. It's Am Yisrael Chai. We're a Jewish people. We're not Ashkenazim. We're not Sephardim. We're not from Poland or Yemen or Iraq. We're just Jews. And the idea of an ethnic list was looked upon with disdain by the general public. There were ethnic lists, but they never passed the threshold in seven consecutive cycles. Finally, in the 10th cycle, in 81, Tommy won a few seats, but that was really a breakaway from the NRP just because of a personality cult of Abuchatzera. But how could in 84 an ethnic list win four seats if it goes against the grain of the Israeli psyche of we don't believe in ethnic lists? So the answer is that they were religious. A religious party fundamentally, and Sephardic secondarily. Now that doesn't mean they were lessening the impact of the Sephardic component of their identity. No. The whole goal was l'hachazir atara liyoshna, to bring back the glory of the Sephardic patrimony to the state of Israel. That they believed that it's been an Ashkenazic state for all these years. Well, you know what? It shouldn't be. We should inject more and more Sephardism and religious Sephardism into the state, and everybody would be well served. So that is different from saying, vote for me because I come from Yemen or I come from Iraq. It's saying we have an ethno-religious heritage that hasn't been the focus of the state, and maybe it should be.
Weren't they a simple majority?
Huh?
51% of the country.
Okay, but most people are not voting on the basis of whether they're Ashkenazic or Sephardic, and that alone. They're voting for a variety of reasons. What kind of people do they try to get? They don't run a big media campaign. Instead, yeshiva students go door to door canvassing the electorate, and they go all to all the places that no other parties want to go, including to the slum neighborhoods and to the prisons. Okay, they like Prislam, so this was like, Shas had their own version of that, of going to the prisoner population. Huh? Not in Israel. Not in Israel. Okay? So this strategy worked very well. But the most important thing that worked was television. They didn't run a big, big campaign, but they had television ads, as all the parties were allowed to do. Except one party didn't run TV ads. And which was that? The Aguda. The Aguda ran TV ads in 1981. And the rabbis were furious after the fact. And so they said, you can't do this again. So in 84, Aguda didn't run TV ads. They ran radio and print, but not television. Television is treif. It's usur. Okay? So, but the Shas, they're not as crazy as the Ashkenazim when it comes to matters of TV and media. So they ran the ads. So Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's picture was in every living room in Israel, but Rav Shach's wasn't, or the Ger Rebbe's wasn't. And that's why they could double their Ashkenazic counterparts.
Also, to get to the point of money, if your body is in the Knesset and involved in things, you're going to get money for your...
Sure. Well, that's... So the Shas spokesman made the following point. He said, for many, many years, the Aguda was busy playing with the money and the politics, and we, the Sephardim, were studying Torah. And now it's time to flip it around, where they can go back to study the Torah, and we'll get involved with the money and the politics. And there's a lot of truth to that. That's really what happened. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Now, there's one group I haven't mentioned. I mentioned the party they voted for, but a religious group that is very important in the diaspora and in Israel that I haven't said yet. What is that? Lubavitch. Who does Lubavitch vote for? So Lubavitch, you would think, would vote for the Aguda, because after all, it's being dominated by Hasidim, and it's their kinsmen. But actually, no. Because the Lubavitchers are very odd in the following way. Is Lubavitch Zionist or anti-Zionist? So Lubavitch is vehemently anti-Zionist and pro-Zionist simultaneously. Okay? That in semantics and supposed ideology, Lubavitch is anti-Zionist. However, in practice, they're very pro-Jewish, and Jewish means pro-Israel, and pro-Israel means fundamentally pro-Israel and very right-wing pro-Israel. So that's why, for example, with the Gaza withdrawal, you had the guys with the hats, with the orange thing around the hat, with the Borsellino, that was to show Amal Chabadnik, who's a Gush Katif guy. So the Lubavitch Rebbe always opposed territorial withdrawal. He was as far to the right as you could get, further than Menachem Begin. Okay, so if you're a Chabadnik, which means you're a chassid, you're a Shomer Shabbos Jew, you're a Haredi Jew, basically, but you're a not one inch type, then who are you going to vote for? You're going to vote for Pole Aguda, which now joined forces with Rav Drukman, so you're going to vote for Mo Rasha. So Mo Rasha did well, they got the same number as the Aguda, because the Chabadniks supported the not one inch crowd. That was how it all played itself out. Okay. Same thing, the Chabadniks are very much opposed to any peace process, anything. Yeah. There's another element to that, which I really shouldn't talk about, but I'll mention it. I'll regel achat. There's a certain anti-Gentile component to Chabad attitude, and that also plays a role in why they're a not one-inch crowd. It's not just that it's Eretz Yisrael, it's that we don't like the other guy. This is anti-Arab sentiment. Yes, yes. Okay, so now, what about on the left? We spoke about the religious. Let's go to the left. So on the left, you had two parties of significance that previously existed, and that is Citizens' Rights, Shulamit Aloni, and Shinui. Shinui was the old holdover from the Democratic Movement for Change from 1977. Each of those parties was very dovish on the peace process and anti-religious coercion. They believed in a very secular state, and they weren't socialist, which meant that they were in favor of open economy. They each did quite well and won 3 seats. So that could bolster, potentially, an alignment government if an alignment victory were to happen. The other groups that exist are Yachad, which was Azer Weitzman's party, which is just people like Azer Weitzman, they voted for him. He won 3 seats. I don't know why he was so popular. I never saw what was so the big deal of Azer Weitzman. And the other was Ometz. Ometz won 1 seat. That was Yigal Hurwitz, which was basically a holdover from Rafi, the old Ben-Gurion party, that was still hanging around. He was able to get 1 seat. But let's now talk about the two controversial parties. Because there's on the far left and on the far right parties that didn't previously exist, whose very legitimacy was called into question. And that is, on the left, the Progressive List for Peace, the PLP, and on the right, Kach, Kahana. Okay, so let's go to the PLP first. The Progressive List for Peace, what's the story with the Arabs? Who do the Arabs vote for? Well, half the Arabs usually vote for the communists. Not because they really are communists, but because the communists were like the agitators who were against the state, who caused trouble. So Raqqa, Rishima Komunistit HaChadasha, was part of Chadash, or Hadash, and it was led by Meir Vilner, a Jew. But really, it was an Arab party. It was a 95% Arab party. They won 4 seats. They always went around 4 or 5. Communists, mixed Arab-Jewish, but basically Arab. So the other half of the Arab vote is up for grabs. Who's going to get it? Now, in the old days, they voted for these satellite lists of the Mapai. They were like patsy organizations of Arabs in the Galilee and in the south who were in the pocket of Ben-Gurion, of Eshkol, of Golda, and they were reliable votes for the Mapai and for the Labor Party. Those votes don't exist anymore. And you know why? Because the Arabs of Israel underwent a transformation. 3 important things happened to them. Number one, modernization. Okay? They speak Hebrew. They're They can read. They're literate. Number two, urbanization. Where did the Arabs live, the Arabs of Israel live in 1949, 1950, 51?
Farms,
villages. There was almost no urban Arab population in Israel. Why? Because they all got turned into refugees. All the Arabs who lived in Jaffa, Haifa, everywhere, the big cities, they're in refugee camps for the last 70 years. Okay? So the early Arab Israelis were all villagers and farmers in out-of-the-way places. But now, a generation later, they're moving into the big cities. And when you move into the big cities, you have your own ideas. You're not just a schnook anymore. You're your own person. So modernization, urbanization, and political radicalization. What radicalized them politically? Number one, maltreatment by the Israelis, the Land Day episode of 1976, and the fact that the Palestinians in the territories are getting messed over under permanent occupation, and these Arab Israelis are commiserating with them over that, and now they don't like Israel so much. So the Arab vote is noticeably more anti-Israel in 1984 than it was in 1954. All right. Well, who are they going to vote for? So one possibility is... Well, they were under military occupation from 1949 to 1966, until it was ended under Eshkol.
And what was the circumstances of the occupation?
It wasn't good. I mean, life for an Israeli Arab in the first two decades of the state was not pleasant. It's not like it is today. Today, Arab Israelis have it pretty good. I mean, it's better than anywhere else in the Middle East. So, who are they going to vote for? They could vote for a Zionist party if they can overcome the emotional hurdle of voting for a Zionist party. And if they do overcome that psychological obstacle, which one are they going to pick? Likud, Labor, one of the little ones? Who are they going to like? So the National Religious Party historically did very well among religious Arab villagers. Why? You would think one has nothing to do with the other. Why would an Arab in a village vote for a knitted yarmulke representative? The answer is because the Ministry of Religious Affairs and the Ministry of Interior were historically National Religious Party ministries. And what do the Arabs who are on the farms care about?
Money,
but money to build the mosque and the madrasa, so religious affairs, and the municipalities where the Arabs have their political power is under the auspices of the Ministry of the Interior. So there's a relationship, historic relationship, between the Maftal, the NRP, and the Arab vote. But that's in decline. More likely, the Arabs will vote for Labor. Simple as that. If you have a choice of Likud and Labor, who's going to win the election? If you're an Arab and you want to see the Jews give up land, so who's going to give up the land? Peres or Shamir? Peres. So vote for Peres, and the Jews will give up land to the Arabs. Simple as that.
Why not just form your own party?
Okay, good. So 24% would vote for the alignment. A significant percentage would vote for the commies. But what about your own Arab nationalist party in the state of Israel running for the Knesset? There had never been one before. But in 1984, it was established. The Progressive List for Peace. Why the word progressive? It has a P in it. What does P stand for?
Palestine.
Bingo. Okay, good. So the PLP stands for Palestine. And they espouse an ideology which is against the Jewish character of the state. They would like to see a state for the citizenry, irrespective of ethnic identity or religious identity, which, you know, is perfectly fine, except that from an Israeli point of view, it's disastrous. So what will the Knesset and the bureaucracy, the election bureaucracy, do with these people? Will they let them run or no? Yes or no? What do you think?
Yes.
So it's going to go before the Commission on Elections, and the vote will be, you're not allowed to run. Who voted to ban them, and who voted not to ban them? So the right-wingers voted to ban the Arabs, and the alignment abstained. Why did the alignment abstain? No. Huh? Okay, good. So the alignment voted to abstain because had the alignment voted in favor of banning the Palestinian party, people would say they did it just to steal the votes. So they abstained to say, We didn't. We are not guilty of trying to steal anybody's vote. Whether we thought yes or we thought no, we held our mouth shut. Okay, a similar thing would happen with Kahana. Let's now talk about Kahana. So he had run in 73, in 77, and in 81, and all three times failed to get anywhere near the threshold. He'd get 5,000 votes each time. In 1984, we'll see he's going to get 26,000 and get in. But before he could even run, he was put before the election commission, and he was banned. And who voted to ban him and who abstained? The left wing voted to ban him, and the Likud abstained. Why did Likud abstain? Again, the same reason why Labor did on the other side. Because if Likud had voted to ban him, everyone would say, you just did it to steal the guy's voters. So we'll keep our mouth shut, we won't say anything, and let it ride. Okay, so no Arab party, no nationalist Arab party, and no Kahana. What do both of those parties do? They appeal to the Supreme Court. What does the Supreme Court say? You can run. Lozum gain. Okay? Yeah. So, now, what ends up happening is the Palestinian party gets two seats, which is pretty good for a first showing. Kahana gets one seat. He gets 1.2% of the vote for one seat, which means just himself, nobody else. Well, what happens after Kahana enters into the parliament? How does he behave himself, and how does everyone behave towards him? So, his first mishagas is that when it's time to take the oath of office, he refuses. He writes his own vows, like a chasana, you know? He writes his own vows, and he wants to say that instead. And the president and the speaker of the Knesset go ballistic. The president is Chaim Herzog, a very illustrious figure. The speaker of the Knesset at that time was Shlomo Hillel. And they both fight tooth and nail to basically use parliamentary maneuvers to get Kahana out of the chamber. If he doesn't want to take the oath, he can't be here. In the end, it gets appealed to the Supreme Court, and Kahana loses, and he takes the oath. Okay, but nobody likes him. The general public didn't really like Kahana that much either, but the members of Knesset had an even greater antipathy percentage-wise than the general public did towards Kahana. They saw the threat that he was to Israeli democracy because of his espousing a forcible transfer, which no other party had ever done. Later on, there'd be the Rechabim Zevi party of Moledet, which would advocate non-forcible transfer, voluntary transfer of the Arab population. And that was considered kosher. But Kahana's forcible transfer was later declared to be racist and no good. So, in 1985, the Knesset passes a law by a vote of 66-0 that says a party can't run for the Knesset if it either is anti-democratic, racist, or negates the Jewish character of the State of Israel. And on that basis, it would be possible to eliminate Kahana-type figures on racism or anti-democratic nature, and Arab parties on the grounds that they're against the Jewish character of the state, and sometimes also anti-democratic. So that for the next 33 years after that law is passed, will play an important role in the life of Israeli politics, even to this day, because after all, they just decided to eliminate somebody.
Wasn't Kahana very popular in the United States? Didn't he have a following?
Sure, he had a following in Israel too. But let's not talk about how big of a following he had. So Kahana's polling data in 1985 in the summer reached a high point. He was at 9% approval. In 1986, it bottomed out at 2% approval. But because he was never able to run again in 88, he was banned, all this is unverifiable. Meaning, I could say anything that I want to a pollster over the phone, but what slip am I going to put in the ballot box? That's a world of difference between what I say to a pollster over the phone. I could like a lot of different parties, but I only get to vote for one of them. So people say, oh, but Kahana was banned, he was about to win and become the third largest party, baloney. We don't know that. We can't know that. It's impossible. So what does Kahana do while he's with his parliamentary immunity for the 4 years that he's in the chamber? Well, he gets into a lot of fights with people, and it became customary that when he would speak, people would leave. Not just the Arabs or the left-wingers who found him offensive, but even the right-wingers who found him offensive. Even Moshe Arons. You don't get pretty much more to the right than Moshe Arons. And he would walk out of the chamber when Kahana got up to speak.
Moshe Arons was a gentleman.
Right.
Pure, good, straightforward.
the antithesis of Kahana, then.
The antithesis of right-wing imagery.
Right, also true, also true. Okay, so... What, came here to Woodmere?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, he came here to speak, and Rabbi Brother
wouldn't let him.
He didn't come physically. They just
what are you talking about?
No, I can't see him. Oh, they wouldn't let him come.
I don't know. I don't know.
He
so.
Had a good story.
Yeah.
I think he was here.
Even though he's broke and all
over. I think he was here.
Yeah. All right.
Harris's current extreme party passed the criteria for being a
shul. Well, because they don't necessarily have a platform that they could pinpoint that says that it's anti-democratic or racist. They have isolated statements of people who are on the list, and they could be eliminated as individuals, as opposed to as the whole party roster. And that's what ends up happening now, that individual people can be said, you're out, because you've said something that's totally objectionable. All right.
Yeah.
Yes, he very often would speak about that the German Sudeten population was expelled from Czechoslovakia in 1945 because of the averas of the Nazis. And so therefore, there's precedent for moving people around to solve world conflict. All right. Well,
who was that?
Yeah, Kahana used to say that, yeah, all the time. He would quote the Sudeten Germans, the Sudeten Germans. Yeah.
East Prussia, too.
East Prussia, yeah.
Poland. Okay.
India and Pakistan, yeah.
Pakistan and India.
Right, okay.
But he so, did predict what is happening now. He predicted it.
No, actually, he was completely wrong, Kahana, about one very important thing.
Yeah.
Kahana believed incorrectly, and now it's 30 years later, so we can see that he was incorrect, that the Israeli Arab population would grow in size such that it would overtake the Jewish population, or that the demographic balance would be out of whack. And that, therefore, from a perspective of parliamentary representation, the Arab parties will all of a sudden have a major block in the Knesset, and it would no longer be an overwhelming majority Jewish state. Well, that never happened. Israel still...
That because of the fall of the Soviet Union.
Correct. So maybe he didn't anticipate that.
Nobody could.
So, but the point is that... Understood, but he was predicting a rise in demographics that never took place, and from a standpoint of representation in the Knesset, the Arabs never got their act together to have the kinds of numbers that they could have had if they all voted the same way. They all voted for Arab parties. That never has happened.
Look, I'm not a Kahana.
Yeah.
But let's say this somehow this transfer of population with money.
Yeah.
Sweeter. Would have gone through. I wonder what the situation would have looked like now.
It's hard to know. It's hard to know. Yeah.
What's going to happen to the Palestinians in Israel that has an eternal land? The West Bank?
Well, so nobody at the top of the Israeli political heap ever had a good solution for the status of such people outside of total withdrawal from those territories and giving it over to some other entity, whether the PLO, Jordan, a PA, you name it. In other words, the left wing has a solution. The right wing never had any solution. The right wing just wanted the status quo forever on the grounds that we can sustain it. And maybe you can. Who knows? Mashiach will come in 1,000 years from now. We'll still be occupying the West Bank. And, who knows? Huh? All right, so that's an example of how the left wing's efforts fell flat, but that doesn't in any way exonerate the right for having no solution.
There is no solution.
That's the problem.
All right,
so
all right, let's get back to what we're discussing. Okay, so after the election was over, what ended up happening? Who runs the country? So the alignment won 44 seats. The Likud won 41. Ordinarily, the guy with the plurality gets to form the government. So Peres should get first shot at forming a government. But he really didn't get a chance to because there was a tie. The tie was 54 to 54 between the two blocks. Because I mentioned ahead of time that most of the parties declared their allegiance to one side of the aisle ahead of time. And
like now.
Well, like pretty much like now, yeah. So, what was the right side of the aisle? Likud had 41, Tehillah had 5, that's 46, Shas had 4, that's 50, Aguda had 2, 52, Morasha had 2, 54, Labor had 44, Ratz, the Citizens' Rights, had 3, is 47, Shinoi had 3, that's 50, Yachad had 3, it's 53, and Nomads had 1, 54. It was a tie 54 to 54. Who did not commit one way or the other?
12 seats.
Who were the 12? Let's take a look. The non-aligned parties were, the National Religious had 4, the Communists had 4, the Palestinians had 2, Tommy had 1, and Kana was 1. So those guys didn't make any promises. Of course, some of those guys can't form a government no matter what. Kahana cannot be in a government. He's crazy. Nobody's going to join with him. Or he's not going to join with anybody. The Communists are not going to join a government. The Palestinians are not going to be in a government. Of what's left, Tommy's not going to be in a government because Abu Khatsera was convicted of crimes. Only the National Religious Party could join a government going forward. But the question is, who are they going to join with? And even if they do, that only gets the other side to 58, because 54 plus 4 is 58. That's not 61. Right. So, the answer is a national unity government. Everybody gets together. Likud and Labor. If you combine them, you can have a government with 100 members. Tremendous number. And that's what happens. The only parties that end up out of government are Tichiyah, because it's too far to the right, Chadash, the Communists, the Palestinians, Tami, because Abu Khatsera was a criminal, and Ratz, because Shulamit Aloni never got along with people. She was a bit of an irascible woman.
And Kahana.
So, everybody else is in. That's a tremendous bunch. It's a lot of parties, a lot of ministerial seats to fill. But who's the boss? Who's going to be the prime minister? The answer is
split it.
Divide the baby. So half the term will go to Peres and half the term will go to Shamir. 1984 to 1986 will go to Peres. 1986 to 1988 will go to Shamir. Does that work? Well, it did. Shockingly, it did. Okay, so how did it work? That's the big question. So in the first 2 years...
Well, didn't each one had their cabinet spheres that didn't change in any...
So most of the ministries had one person in charge the whole length of the term. Only the foreign minister and prime minister seats flip-flopped, where Shamir was first prime minister and then foreign and then prime, and Peres was first prime and then foreign. Everybody else stayed the same. Rabin was the defense minister the whole way through. Okay. Well, it worked because there were two major issues Israel had to resolve. Number one, the economy was terrible. It had to be turned around. Number two, Lebanon war had to come to an end. And each party needed the other for one of those two things. Labor needed Likud to end the Lebanon war because Labor could not, as a left wing, as a dovish party, back out of an Israeli war without the consensus of the major right wing party. Otherwise, it would look unpatriotic or weak, you know. And Likud needed Labor on the economy because Likud didn't know what it was doing. Right? It had run the finance ministry and the budget into the ground. So they needed the cooperation of Labor to make it all possible. Once those two issues were resolved, and they were resolved in 1985 with a pullout from Lebanon to the security zone, to the 11-mile security zone, and the economy was resolved by changing over the shekel to the shekel chadash, the new shekel, at 100-to-1 ratio. So after that was taken care of, then the partisan bickering became very intense. But in the beginning, they really did cooperate on the critical issues that were facing the country. Okay, so there's a problem, though. The prime minister, by law, has the right to fire a minister who's been insubordinate. But the cabinet was so delicately balanced between right and left, Labor and alignment, Likud and alignment, that if you fire somebody, it changes the dynamic and one side has a majority and can force its will on the other. So they made a gentleman's agreement that no minister could be fired without the consent of both leaders, Peres and Shamir. So did this happen? Was there an incident where somebody was going to get fired? Yes, twice. The first one was Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon said very disparaging comments about Shimon Peres, as was his minhag for many, many years to do that. Okay? And The irony of ironies is that later on they both ended up in Kadima and sort of made peace at the very end. But he made disparaging comments about Peres, and Peres wanted to fire him. So he threatened to do it, but Shamir was wishy-washy about giving a hechsher for this for a firing. And in the end, Sharon apologized. He and Peres accepted the apology.
What cabinet ministry did he have?
It was housing, I believe. So.
And he had a good record on that.
Well, yeah. So. The other one was Yitzhak Modai. Yitzhak Modai was the finance minister and was the leader of the Liberal Party. Now, the Liberal Party had long been thinking about breaking away from the Likud and forming its own branch because they didn't agree with all the hawkish positions on the territories of the Likud. And they also were believed in more of a capitalist economy and an unregulated economy as opposed to the Chirut, which wanted populism. So Modai said nasty things about Peres, and Peres wanted to fire him. But again, that would have caused a problem. So in the end, they agreed, we'll remove him from the finance ministry and make him the justice minister, and we'll take the justice minister and make him the finance minister. Well, then what did that solve? It solved nothing. But it goes to show you that they had to play games and musical chairs because it's a very delicate circumstance. The removal of even one person could upset the whole apple cart. Okay.
Could you comment on what's the strategy that the leaders of these small parties who are prepared to identify with either the right or the left, why do they maintain their independence in terms of negotiating their best outcome?
Oh, because they have a voting base that likes them for their particular issue that's important to them. So, for example, Citizens' Rights Movement, that party were for people who wanted to make the single issue in their life no religious coercion. And while I'll vote for a small party, even though I won't necessarily affect the outcome of the general election, although they thought they would, because I want freedom to eat pork, or I want to drive a bus on Shabbos, all right? That's for citizens' rights.
Or if they join a coalition?
No. They fight for what they believe in. Or Techia, I believe in Eretz Israel, not one inch. And so I'm not going to vote for Likud, because I think Likud is going to negotiate with the Arabs, but Techia won't. So I vote for them. Everybody has a reason why, usually one reason and one reason only, they vote for the small party. But it's important enough to them that they pull the lever for that group. Okay, so, in 1986, there's a tremendous pressure on Shimon Peres not to honor the rotation agreement, and instead to hold on to power. Now, how could he do that? If they had a signed agreement, how could he do that?
He gets more to his side.
So one of two ways. One way is to say the agreement doesn't hold true anymore, and it's now fair game to form a new coalition, and if I can cobble together a majority, bingo, I'm the prime minister again. But he really couldn't do that because he didn't have the numbers to do that. The other is call for new elections. But he can't unilaterally call for new elections. The Knesset would have to dissolve itself. But he could resign as prime minister, which by law means the entire cabinet resigns, which in effect would have meant new elections. So although he couldn't do it directly, he could do it indirectly. He really had the capacity to end this whole charade and have a new election. The problem was there was no real justification for it other than his own desire for power. Like, there was no pressing issue where the government wasn't functioning that would justify saying, let's go to the polls. So because he didn't have a real good reason, he didn't do it. And also, what do people say about Shimon Peres? What's his reputation, his legacy?
Slick.
Can't win an election.
Yes, but slick, what else? Dishonest, right? That he would say anything to get elected. So many people had a very dim view of Shimon Peres, and they thought that he was not, he didn't play fair, that he used techniques which were underhanded. And in fact, he would in 1990 especially. But in 1986, he was very self-aware of what people thought of him. And he did not want to be accused of acting in bad faith. If he called for new elections in 86 and messed over Yitzhak Shamir and Shamir never became prime minister again, everyone would forever say Shimon Peres was a scoundrel. So he didn't want that. He was willing to give up power lest he be called a scoundrel. So he gave up power. But having given up power, he didn't give up all responsibility. He became foreign minister, and behind Shamir's back, acted time and again to advance a peace process that Shamir didn't believe in. So we're going to stop here, but next time we're going to discuss what does the government do between 1986 and 88 under changing diplomatic circumstances where the government is speaking with two voices. There's a prime minister who's a not one inch guy, and there's a foreign minister who's a dove, or who's becoming much more dovish, and believes in territorial withdrawal and an agreement with some Arab party, whether the Palestinians, the Jordanians, whomever. And so you have a foreign minister conducting foreign policy against the wishes of the prime minister. Had that ever happened before? It happened sometimes. It had happened previously when a defense minister was doing that. And who was that? David Ben-Gurion, to Moshe Sharet. So it's a very ugly situation, and we'll continue next time. Okay.